pity and tolerance that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. You know what that guy did? What if I found out he had a brain tumor that drove him to do that? Man, I'd think a lot different about him. And I'll tell you, there's a dynamic that I've noticed with some consistency in the realm of the Spirit, that when prayer meets action of anticipation to God's hand, miracles start to, incredible things start to happen. So that's why when I ask God in this prayer to help me to show him this, then my job is to try to act towards them as if God's already, he's bringing it to me. Like he's bringing it. So he's putting it on the table already. I might as well just start acting like that towards that guy. And when my willingness to act different towards them and my change my attitude, which my attitude, Scott could tell you more about this than I can. Pilots talk about attitude. It's an angle of approach. And you have a bad attitude, you keep crashing into the mountain. You adjust your angle of approach to get a different result out of the landing. And so when I start making those two things come together, my willingness to change my angle of approach and God's and my beseeching God for the ability to do that, it starts to change. There was a guy in the Ohio area who's a legend in Alcoholics Anonymous. He died 20 years, sometime in the mid-80s, I think, a guy named Mose Yoder. I don't know if anybody here has ever heard of Mose. He was an old Amish guy who got sober with a beard, and one of the Amish guys, and he was in the Cleveland, Akron, Pennsylvania area. He was a giant in AA back then. And Mose had quoted the old saying about if you pray for potatoes, get a hoe. Which means it doesn't mean, like I've shared that with some of the guys I sponsor that are from the hood, and they think that means something completely different. But what he's saying, if you're going to pray towards something, then start doing what's necessary to allow that, put yourself in the arena. Make yourself, start acting differently towards this person. I'll tell you a little story. Probably 17 years ago. 16 at least, I suppose. I was listening to a fifth step of a guy who, he had a bad resentment. And we got into about a middle third of the way probably through his resentment list, and the worst one was in the middle, and he brought it out. It was towards his father, and it was a tough deal. He was raised by a father who was an active alcoholic, and he was a bad drunk. I mean, bad to the point where he'd get drunk and in drunken rage just beat this kid repeatedly until on a couple occasions the kid ended up in the hospital. And sometimes his dad would be hung over, and that would be just as bad. Because he'd scream and he'd yell and get to your room and you're stupid and on and on and on. And just the verbal and emotional and mental abuse and the physical abuse. And then on one or two occasions, his dad would get sober. We suspect he might have even gone to AA for a brief period, but he never stayed sober. But during those periods of sobriety, and he would really try to have a different attitude, and he'd say, I'm sorry, and I'm going to get you a bicycle and take you to Disneyland, etc. But he'd go back to drinking again, and then all the failed promises, he'd hate himself for them, and then he'd beat the kid even more, and it would just get worse, you know, it was worse. And this is a resentment that has owned this guy for a couple decades. And he'd spent time in therapy trying to get free from it. He did everything in therapy you could do, from the gestalt and beating pillows to the gestalt chair to, you know, everything. And he could never get free of it, really. And it owned him, and it affected his relationships with people and his ability to work for people. And it was a bad deal. And we'll get to this part, and he's telling me about all this, and he's talking about the different, he had about four things that his dad really caused all this resentment. And four or five, actually maybe more, maybe five. And we're talking about it, and then I take him to the bottom of page 66 and the top of 67, where it says that we must realize how this person is perhaps like us, spiritually sick. And I said to him, I said, you've got to realize how you and your father are alike, how you're like your dad. And he flipped out on me, and he started yelling at me. He says, I'm not like my father. My father's a damn animal. And yeah, he went on and on. He scared me. All this venom started coming out of it. And he freaked me out. I felt the anger and the rage coming out of him. So I just backed off. I thought, well, this guy's not prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle, I guess. So I just said, you just go on with another one. And he starts reading this next resentment, and I can't hear him because something's going on with me. And I don't know what, I don't really understand what it is, but I think it's an intuitive thing. I think it occurred because before I listened to a fifth step, I always get quiet and ask God to help me to be useful. My friend Bob from Minneapolis, or from St. Paul, says, I never am the well, but sometimes I get to be the pipe. And what came to me next was not of me, but through me. And I stopped him and I said, something's bothering me. I want to go back to another one of these, one of the previous resentments. He says, you want to talk more about my dad, huh? No, I said, no, I don't. I want to go back towards the beginning. That woman that you were resentful at for leaving you, that relationship with those kids and stuff, I want to go back to that. And he says, what of it? And I said, I was just wondering if any time in that deal with those kids, if you were ever drunk or stoned on drugs or hung over, or you might have ever done anything to hurt those kids. And he puts his head down, and I don't know what's going on with him, and I'm getting a little uncomfortable. And he finally raises his head up, and he's got tears coming down his face. And in this choked whisper that sounded like it didn't even sound like his voice, like it came out of some abyss, he said, I'm just like my goddamn father, with tears running down his face. I said to him, I said, how did you feel about yourself when you hurt those kids? He said, I couldn't get drunk enough. He said, you think your dad's any different? And he said to me, he said, my dad's, I haven't seen my dad in several years, and he's older, and my sister tells me about him, and he lives in a trailer, and he's evidently he's miserable, and he physically can't drink anymore. He's got pancreatitis and some liver problems, and his body has forced him into a state of abstinence from alcohol, and evidently he's the most negative, lonely, fear-filled, miserable person that my sister's ever seen. And I said, do you think that you could be like that? And he said, maybe that's a vision of my future without Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the first time in his life, he started to see himself in his father. Now, this is not exonerating his father for his wrongs or saying, well, it wasn't wrong. It's not about that. It's really getting the sick part of you that could have done that. It's really getting the part of you that you deny in yourself that he denies in him. It's really getting the deal that's going on and starting to understand it. Or as it says, because in step 10, it's going to talk about our next deal is to grow in understanding and effectiveness, and which implies by step 10, we've started to grow in understanding somewhere. And I think this is where we start to do that. Because for me, it was the first time in my whole life I ever really got honest enough and other-centered enough to get out of my own judgmental feel up in here to actually get in the shoes of the other people. To other-center myself enough to see myself in them. And from that, I started to get free. And the prayer... The middle of page 67, as we get prepared, as we start to create what is necessary to go on with steps 6, 7, 8, and 9, we ask ourselves these questions. And twice in this paragraph, it says something. It says, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. Putting out of our minds what they did. The idea that that guy was a lousy parent and he beat me and all that stuff, I got to put that out of my mind because and answer these questions. It even goes further down and says, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. And I think that this is crucial because I am an expert at hiding my bad actions in the shadow of your indiscretions and wrongs. I'm the kind of guy that if I worked for a boss and I could catch him taking something home or doing something a little bit out of line, it was almost like a license to steal from him. And I think that maybe on some level that that's the reason I was so judgmental, because I needed the leverage to justify this selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, judgmental, angry person that I was. So I was always looking to see what's wrong with you. It's like the dumbwaiter effect. The illusion is I can pull you down enough and I'll come up. I bet it never works. That never works. And so for the first time in my life and the first time in my friend's life and all of our lives, we're asked to do something we've never done. And my friend had to look to see what kind of a son he was. Not in the light of all the things his dad did wrong, but in its own life. You know, because it says earlier, we're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. Well, what if I just really disregarded what my father did? And what if he was the perfect father? Then, in that light, from that different angle, what kind of a son was I? And when I did that through my whole life, it was horrible. I don't want to do that. I don't want to look at it that way. Because, for one, it's somewhere in the back of my mind, I know this is going to cost me because my 8-step list is going to get longer. Right? And he realized that he'd been a lousy son. He'd gossiped and slandered his father. He went out of his way to get everybody in the family against him. He used everything his dad did as a sick, out-of-control, drunk alcoholic to justify all kinds of selfish, vindictive behavior. And for the first time in his life, he looked at it, he took the responsibility. And he went to make amends to his dad, and he called me from right outside the trailer park. He was scared. I said, "What are you afraid of?" He said, "The monster." I guess it was the monster of his childhood, you know. And we talked a little bit about God and about what you're trying to do here. And he went, I said, "Call me as soon as you're done." And he called me, and he it was like there was a different thing in his voice. I said, "What did you find?" He said, I knocked on the door. He said, I was shaking inside. And what answered the door was not the monster. It was a little scared old man who was alone and vacant. And he said he looked in his dad's eyes and he saw himself. And he was able to make amends to his father for his side of the street, disregarding what his dad did entirely. And started to carry that through with starting to be the son he never was. And he took care of his dad a lot in the last years of his life. And I heard him at a meeting in Vegas one time say that the best thing Alcoholics Anonymous had ever given him next to his sobriety was he got his daddy back. Now that's an amazing thing. You can't get that. You can't wish that to happen. There's something that happens when I change my attitude or my angle of approach and bring God's grace into bear that will just change stuff so amazingly. And that's really what we're doing here. It's not enough to pray for these people. That in itself is a good act. But I have to be willing at the same time to look at this stuff from an entirely different angle. And if I'm willing to change my angle of approach and I ask for God's grace and power, these things just do stuff. And I can't tell you what's going to happen to you after the cleaning house steps, except that you will be different. That's everybody's different. And sometimes you don't know you're different right away. Sometimes maybe 6 or 8 months after you do your fifth step and you're halfway into your amends, you start realizing you're getting a different result out of your interaction with people. You're feeling differently about yourself. You're not as hard on yourself. And I started getting that because as I started to understand and have compassion for you, and eventually even some empathy and love for these people I'd so misjudged, a funny thing happened, is it came around on me. You see, when I unleash the dogs of judgment, the problem is they never stop with biting you. Because in the wee hours of the morning, after a bad day, I turn them on me. And I get to the... That's what depression is all about. I start whipping myself and beating up myself. And everybody I've ever met wants to be free from self-pity and depression and all that stuff. And they want to be free from the self-flagellation and beating yourself up and putting yourself down. But the only way you get free from that is you've got to stop doing it to others first. As Scott talked about in the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our trespasses as implies a connected, interactive process. I can't take myself off the hook and feel free in the realm of the Spirit till I take you off the hook first. There exists no reality that includes I'm okay and you're all idiots. It doesn't happen. It don't work like that. It don't work like that. I'm going to talk a little bit about fear for a couple minutes and then I'll turn. Then turn back to you.
See what time.
Okay. Fear inventory was a hard deal for me. Now, here, picture this in your mind. I'm sober over 4 years. I just finished the resentment section. And I've listed everybody I'm resentful at. I was able to do this was our course. I said the prayer. I'm good to go. I got my list of for my eighth step eventually coming right out of that. And I sat there at the kitchen table with this legal pad and I wrote fears across the top of the page and I'm drawing a blank. I can't come up with anything. And I sat there and I thought, well, I know when I first got sober I was afraid of going to prison and homelessness and a bunch of stuff, but all that stuff's been taken care of. I said, well, you know, I pray every day. Maybe I'm just not afraid. Maybe I don't have any fear. Maybe AA works some way or something. And I went to an intergroup meeting. We have a monthly speaker meeting in Las Vegas. And I went to this meeting, and I heard this guy talk, and after the meeting I went up to him, and a bunch of us went out, coffee, and we're sitting around, and I start telling him about this inventory. And I said, I'm working on my fear list. And I said, you know, I don't have any fears. And he looks at me, and he said, really? I said, yeah, you know, I just don't have any fears. He said, you don't have any fears? I said, no, I don't. He said, can I ask you some questions? Yeah, sure. He said, are you afraid of large, angry, barking dogs? Well, yeah, but everybody's afraid. We're not talking about everybody. We're talking about you. Are you afraid? Well, yeah, I'm afraid of large, angry dogs. Okay, good, you can put that down. Are you afraid of rattlesnakes? Well, man, everybody's... We're not talking about everybody. We're talking about you. Okay, yeah, I'm afraid of rattlesnakes. Are you afraid of black widow spiders? Yeah, I'm afraid of black widow spiders. Are you afraid of being embarrassed? Ooh, yeah, I am. Are you afraid of what other people think of you? Are you afraid of growing old alone? Are you afraid no one will ever love you? Are you afraid of getting sick and can't take care of yourself? Are you afraid of being unemployed? Are you afraid of being found out? Some of the secrets inside you. Some of your feelings. Are you afraid that God wasn't really going to take care of you and love you? Are you afraid of things out of your past catching up with you? And he went on and on and on. He finally said, you know, so is there anything you're not afraid of? I don't know how he did that. I mean... It's some kind of jujitsu of the spirit or something. I don't know what that's about. But I have all of a sudden realized exactly what it talks about in this page of the book, where it says it's an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. I'm looking for fear like a fish is looking for water, because it is the fabric of my existence. It's the driving force. Earlier in the book it says we're driven by 100 forms of fear. And it's the driver. I lied a lot in my life, but I never lied because I'm a liar. I lied because I was afraid. I was afraid of your judgment. I was afraid of what you'd think of me. I stole a lot of stuff, and I manipulated a lot of stuff, and I cheated people, but I never stole and cheated because I'm a thief and a cheater. I stole because I was afraid. I was afraid of not having anything. I was afraid. I had this view of the universe that is one of the wrongs, the things I'm wrong about, as if there's a limited amount of abundance and I'm not going to get my share. So I better take. And I've known people that have made careers, whole lives of that. And the end result is they have nothing. Because that stuff doesn't work. It doesn't work. The book says it should be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Years ago, I sat with an old-timer who was dying of natural causes. A wonderful man. If you've never had the experience of watching someone in Alcoholics Anonymous that's sober a long time, that's done a lot of service, and is close to God, die, it's an amazing experience. It's not bad. You would think it was. It's a bittersweet thing because you know you're going to miss them. But it's an amazing thing to watch the transformation of their soul as they get ready to cross over to the other side. And I'm sitting with this guy talking to him, and he said to me, he says, you know, oddly enough, when you get in the home stretch and you look back over your life, it's not the mistakes that I regret so much. It's the things I was afraid to try. The love that I was afraid to open myself up to. The opportunities for abundance and richness and great experiences that I was too afraid of how I was going to look or what people would think, so I went like this. And I thought, man, that's really right. I'll tell you, nothing has robbed me of my life more than fear. You know that there are people in my life today that are very important to me that I kept like this because I was afraid. If there's a movie, I'm not one who recommends movies because I don't think that's our job in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I will recommend this one. If you've never seen the movie Pay It Forward, do yourself a favor. See that movie. If you don't see another movie this year, go out and get that DVD and rent it. And it's a tremendous recovery movie. And there's a scene in there where Kevin Spacey and Helen Hunt are having this dialogue in the parking lot. And they've been circling each other with not having a relationship, but kind of like always on the verge of almost having one, kind of, that kind of deal, right? They're doing that dance of make you crazy dance, right? And she says to him something that was so brilliant. She said, you're afraid that I'm going to reject you. She says, I can't. You're too quick for me. And he would reject her under his fear that he'd be rejected. I've done that all my life. I've kept people like this. I've discounted people. And then I have to justify that position by finding stuff wrong with them. And what's the bottom line? What's the core? Isn't the core is I'm afraid they're not going to like me? Or I'm afraid that they're going to reject me? So I beat you to it. And so I got people in my life today that are very precious to me today that I did that to for a number of years. My sponsor, my first 10 years of sobriety, I kept him like this, and he's an idiot. He's so arrogant. You know what the real thing is? I'm afraid I don't want to get him too close to me because he has an ability to kind of cut right into the core of stuff. I don't want anybody too close like that, right? I I know the truth will set you free, but I don't like the initial shock of it. I mean, it's just... And I'm afraid he's not going to like me. I'm afraid I'm not going to measure up. So I beat him to it. I rejected him. I've done that a lot in my life. I don't do things like that because I'm stupid or I'm self-destructive. I do it because I'm driven. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-pity, self-delusion, self-seeking. I step on the toes of people about me. Sometimes they hurt me, sometimes they retaliate. But I'm the guy. I am the seat, the source, and the center of my separation through my judgment. And all my fears I was wrong about. All the things I was so afraid of, I was wrong because I was trusting this rather than trusting God. And that's what the book says, the answer. It asks the question, why do we have these fears? And it says, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And it did. I heard a guy years ago say something I thought was, it made me laugh, but it was so right on the money. He says, I have never been hurt by a problem in my life as much as I have by my solutions to my problems. Oh, man, that's really true, too. I've had stuff that I think, I like Scott's line about clearing up the wreckage of your future. I have an ability, I have this need to solve problems that haven't occurred yet, you know, and I'll solve them, and what happens is I make them come true. One of my first relationships, I was so afraid that this gal was going to dump me. But what the fear did is it drove me to become the possessive, smothering person that literally drove her out of my life. Drove her out. And what's the exact nature of my wrongs? My actions? Well, yeah, I guess. But isn't it the initial judgment that is the fear? The fear. What's the initial judgment of my ego? She's going to reject me. So I defend myself against that and make it come true. And you know what happened on the day she left me and went off with somebody else? There's a little voice in the back of my head. In the middle of my desolation, I feel like drinking. It is horrible. It feels like somebody shot me in the gut. In the middle of that, there's a little voice in the back of my head that said, see, you were right. I like being right. Devastated, almost dead, but right. Right's good. If you have an ego like mine, you don't care about it. Your ego doesn't care if it kills you, as long as it's right. That's all it cares about. And so once again, I'm looking at how wrong I've been about some of this stuff, because I relied on me, and I hadn't trusted God. And that's the answer, is to trust God. Let's have one quick little story. Okay. I didn't know what trust was. And I was in early sobriety, and I was in a retreat. I sat with this old-timer. And I don't know what's wrong with me. What's really wrong is I haven't done the steps yet. I've done the first three and a BS version of four, but I haven't really done the steps yet. And I'm nuts. Because every morning I get up and I say the third step prayer, and 15 minutes later, I'm in my head running the universe with all the judgments and you know, all that crap. And I'm telling this guy that, and he says to me, well, do you have faith in God? And I said, yeah, I know. I'm sober longer than I've ever been in my whole life. I didn't do that. I know that's God. I failed. I know it's God. He said, you have faith? I said, yeah, I do. I have faith in God. He said, you pray every day. I said, pray every day. And he said something to me that I had never heard before. He said, guys like you and I can have all the faith in the world and pray regularly and still die of alcoholism. He said, what we must have is trust. And I guess I looked at him like, I don't get it. I don't get what you're saying. And he says, let me tell you the difference. Maybe you'll get a view of the position you need to take. He said, if you went to a circus and you sat in the audience and you watched a tight wire act and you watched a guy come out to the edge of the wire on the platform pushing a wheelbarrow, you could easily sit in the audience and have all the faith in the world. This guy is a professional. He can walk across that tight wire pushing that wheelbarrow. You'd say to yourself, I bet you he's done that 1,000 times. Absolute faith he could do it. But if you had trust, you'd go up and get in the wheelbarrow. When he said that, oh, I knew exactly what he was talking about. I thought, oh, no. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, you mean I got to actually live my life and stop defending myself and managing? And oh, no, no, I don't want to. I want to talk about getting in the wheelbarrow. I'd like to read about getting in the wheelbarrow. I'd like to go to discussion meetings and discuss getting in the wheelbarrow. But I don't want to get in the wheelbarrow because I'm afraid. I'm afraid because I secretly believe I'll get in that wheelbarrow. I'll get about halfway up that wire and I'm going to hear a voice goes, "Oh, is that Bob?" So if you're wired that way, and the answer is to trust infinite God rather than your finite selves, and yet you're wired like I am, you've got a problem. And if there's a hell on earth, it exists in the abyss between knowing you should be, who you should be and where you should be and who you really are. See, I know stuff about me for years that I can't do. I knew I should have quit smoking years before I was able to quit smoking. I knew I should have got sober years before I got sober. I knew I should be in that wheelbarrow. I knew that intellectually beyond a shadow of a doubt. But that didn't mean I was in it. And what happens to guys like me? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Thanks. What happens, page 53, is exactly what happens to guys like me over and over and over again. It says, when we became alcoholics, crushed by self-imposed crisis, we could not postpone or evade. I want you to know, I have been crushed by self-imposed crises that I could not postpone or evade sober. And not just once, but many times. I've gone on self-will binges sober that have just backed me into a corner. And in that spot, it says we had to fearlessly face the proposition that God is either everything or else he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? You see, when you are crushed by those, by the own results of your own self-will sober, and you know that you did this to yourself, and you know that you don't deserve the help, but yet you need the help, and there's nowhere else to go, what will happen is you will find yourself scared to death, crawling into that wheelbarrow because there's nowhere else to go. And there's nothing else. I'm either going to drink, I'm going to put a pistol in my head, or I'm going to get in that wheelbarrow and act like a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and act like God's in charge and is going to take care of me, even when I don't feel like I deserve it, and even when where I don't believe he will. And what happens every single time I've done that, I come out the other side, and I've been taken care of. And oh my God, God's not the judgmental, vindictive person I always was afraid he was. And he's okay. But it's good. And I don't know if you have to go through that, be forced into that wheelbarrow 10 times before the next time you go, oh man, okay. And what happens is you just start getting into it and you start living it. And I guess every time I had to go through that, it was like another brick and this thing called trust that I'm developing between me and God. This thing that I will base my life upon until one day you'll start to get it, and really get it, that the power behind you will always be greater than the obstacles before you. And that's where the reliance on God starts to come in. It starts to become almost a second nature to us. Things go bad. Oh, this is frightening. That God's going to take care of me. You know why I can say that? Because he's done it so many times before. Why would I suspect that this is going to be the first time he does it? When he's got a track record now with me. And I don't believe easily. That's how I come to believe, really. That's how I come to trust God. Scott wanted me to talk about why we don't look for our part. I said that for years in the last part of the resentment section. We're referring back to our list again. We ask ourselves these questions. It's on page 67 if you want to look. Referring to our list again. I say to people, well, this is where we look for our part. And it started to bother me kind of peripherally, and I didn't understand why. And I'm sponsoring a guy, and I got it one day because he came back to me. He just went to make amends to someone who he had sort of screwed over, but the guy had really screwed him over a little bit more first. And he went to this guy, and he made his amends, and he apologized, and then he stood there and started getting pissed because the guy wasn't making amends now. After all he'd done, he'd humbled himself, and he said a couple things which really undid the whole thing he was there for. It really caused more problems with him and this guy, and he's calling me up, and he doesn't know what to do, and I've screwed this amends up. And he said, I don't know why, I cleared up my part. And when he said that to me, I got it. I realized the danger with that in thinking in those terms is, okay, I got a part. But I've always secretly in the back of my mind know that there's a bigger part. And okay, I've made my amends, and come on, you know, I've done it all right. The book doesn't say that. It says disregard the other person involved entirely. This is not about looking for my part, because if I think in terms of my part, I am subconsciously still allowing the existence of their part. And the book says I have to disregard them entirely. It's my inventory, not the other stuff.
Just a couple of quick pieces, and we'll take a break. Continuing on page 68 in the fear inventory. Middle paragraph, we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. It tells us that twice in this paragraph. Laughing at people think spirituality is the way of weakness, it's the way of strength. The verdict of the ages, faith means courage. Men of faith have courage, they trust their gods. We've been talking about, we never apologize for God. It says, instead we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him, that looks like a prayer to me. So here in the fear inventory, I've listed my fears, I've made a number of observations about them, now here's a prayer. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us do. And that is not what it says. It says, what do you have me be? I'm always worried about what he would have me do. And I found out what he would have me be. It's on page 133 in the text. Second line. It's one of the things we're sure of. It says, we are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And I think anything I can add to that list, it fits. Well, if I can't get my sponsor on the phone, if it'll fit on that list, it's good. Happy, joyous, free, and faithful to my wife. Yep, that's it. Happy, joyous, free, trying to be a good dad. Mm-hmm. Happy, joyous, free, cheating on my taxes. Okay. Back in 68. Direct our attention to what He would have us be. And I can only be in the moment. Back into the now is not when I find God, but where. Be is about now. And then it says that once we commence to outgrow fear, if I can outgrow fear, it must be that fear is a lack of growth, spiritual growth, I guess. It says, now about sex, and we're tight on time. I'm going to sum up the next paragraph. It says, some people are crazy. And how am I doing?
I think you got it.
Okay, good, especially in this category. And some are off on one side and some are off on the other, and we don't want to go there. And about eight lines down, it says, we want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. And boy, if they don't, I don't. This is another one I got from my great mentor. I said, yeah, but what do you do in this category? And someone told me a long time ago that dating before you've actually done the 12 steps is like pouring Miracle-Gro on your character defects. And I think that's probably right. At my home group, they say two ding-a-lings don't make a bell. Yeah, just because the rocks in his head are a perfect match for the holes in hers doesn't mean that this is going to work out. Doesn't mean that. And yet, how can I not be the arbiter of his sex conduct? And he said, here's what I do with a single guy, obviously. I say to him, I'm going to ask you to leave the ladies alone until we get through these steps. One of the reasons is because as sick as you are, your chances of attracting a healthy female are minuscule. Now, you may have done so and you might have one fooled for a while. But eventually, healthy females run screaming from guys like you. And one of the characteristics of having finished these steps is we'll get you healthy, which will give you the opportunity to attract a healthy female. And I'll be cheering for it at that point. But for right now, I'm going to ask you to leave them alone. First, you can't find a healthy one. Second, when you're not healthy enough. Third thing is that I want your time and energy on this step work so that we can dig this poison out of your soul and let you be a different guy. You may choose to ignore my suggestions in this category. That will be your choice. Don't bring me the problems you create for yourself in this category. I've already told you what I think you need to do. It solves my problem. I don't have to listen to it. I've already told him what I think he needs to do. That was a great gift for me. And then it says, we all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. Here's the question. What can we do about them? That's what we're about here. We reviewed our own conduct over years past. Where had we been? Selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Gee, that list sounds vaguely familiar. Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably be around jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. Doesn't how to tell us how to get down on paper. One of my mentors did it in sentence form. I got kind of used to inventory and columns, and I like that. But I think there are a lot of great ways to do this. If we start with whom had we hurt as a first column, the rest of them lay out pretty easily. And I'm gonna do some personal stuff now. I hope not to offend anyone. I'm doing this because part of what keeps the garbage in my past clean and light is my willingness for God to use it. And that's all this is about. That is all this is about. The last column, what should we have done instead? I've only got three entries in my last column. And you've got to realize this is the selfies. This is only where I've done harm. Right? It didn't call for the things I did right in this category. And my last column says one of these three things. It says I should have told her the truth. It says I should have left her alone. Or it says I should have told him no. I'm a heterosexual male. I had my last homosexual experience when I was 19 years old. I had been so beaten down as a child that I couldn't tell anyone no. I was 19. And I want you to tell you, nothing happened in here. I just told you all that. I'm really okay with the whole thing at this point because I've been through the forgiveness process located earlier in step four. And I share that because a very gifted therapist told me that she believed about 70% of adult heterosexual males that had a homosexual experience of some kind. I'm going to say 98 is a better number. I have heard well over 100 fist staff. I've only heard two that didn't have that. So if that's the one you're holding, guys, don't let it kill you. You can come talk to me about it if you want to. I'd be more than happy to. Let's save your life. Our secrets are going to kill us. Anyway, next sentence. It says, in this way we try, what are we trying to do? It says we're trying to shape a sane and sound ideal for a future sex life. That's our purpose here, not to beat ourselves up for what we did in the past. Subjected each relation to this test, was it selfish or not? Boy, that selfish thing comes up a lot, doesn't it? It says, we ask God, that looks like a prayer. So we're going to talk to God about sex. It's okay to do that. God's the one that invented sex. Good job. We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. Remembering always our sex powers are God-given, therefore good, neither be used lightly or selfish, neither be despised and loathed. And I asked them at this point, let's pray. Let's ask God, let you and God talk about what your sexual ideal should be. And by the way, we're not talking about a size 6 that's this tall. No, no, no. It's not about what she looks like. It's about what your conduct should be given the current set of circumstances. Let's use the word today in this one. Like, we don't need to know if you're single, like what it would be if you were married but temporarily separated but not legally separated but you thought she had a boyfriend but you didn't know. We don't need that one right now. What we need very simply is, what do you think God wants you to do in this category given your current set of circumstances? Mine's simple. I'm married to a fabulous woman. She's supposed to get all my sexual energy. Mine is real simple. Yours may not be. And then I want you to write it down. So you'll know what it is. If you write it down, you'll know what it is. It's rattling around in there like a BB in a boxcar. I don't know whether we're going to be able to find it when we need it. Let's write it down. If you want to share it with me, I'd be happy to hear it. I don't require that. Next paragraph. Whatever ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it, to make amends where we have done harm. Gee, that sounds familiar. Here we are again in step four with a willingness to make amends. Provided we don't do more harm in doing so. In other words, we treat sex as any other problem. Well, how is that? Well, we pray about it. We talk to God about it. We try to come up with a sane and sound thing to do. That's what I do with my problems. And here we are talking to God again in meditation. We ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. Let's turn the page. This next paragraph says that we can talk to people, but God should be the final judge. I don't want to be the final judge. I can't afford the price. I don't want to run your life if I sponsor you. I want to run your program of recovery. I don't know if you need to get married, get divorced, move to San Diego, buy a dog, quit your job. How would I know? My life's unmanageable. I can't manage mine. I sure can't manage yours. I'd like to manage your program of recovery. I think I can do it. By the way, I got somebody else managing mine. I call him sponsor. I call him sponsor at least once a week, and I do what he says. My disease continues to reside up here. When I make the commitment that if my sponsor says that I'm doing it, I take my disease out of the decision-making process as it applies to my recovery. It is that simple. My disease still got voice, doesn't have vote anymore. Continuing on page 70. This next paragraph says, I'm going to summarize, if you keep making mistakes and hurting people here, you're going to drink again. It's that simple. If you make a couple and you're serious about changing and you get changed, you'll probably be okay. That's what it says. And it doesn't say that's a maybe. It says these are facts out of our experience. And then it says, to sum up about sex, we earnestly, here we are, praying again. Earnestly pray. Apparently we're supposed to talk to God a bunch about this category. For the right ideal, for guidance in these questionable situations, for sanity and the strength to do the right thing. As sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves harder into helping others. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when you yield with mean heartache. This next paragraph is what pilots call a checklist. If you've done a four-step some other way, see if you can answer that you've done all the things described here. If not, you might want to try the actual four-step, very cleverly concealed here in the book. It says, yeah, that's one of our best-kept secrets. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. If you have followed all of the writing instructions we have located this afternoon. You will have written down a lot. See, we have listed and analyzed our resentments. We covered that, didn't we? I remember some lists. I remember a number of analyses that we did. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. Yeah, I remember 7 death threats on one page. I remember futile. Yeah, we did that. We've commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We did that. We've begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. I certainly remember where we did that, don't you? It says we have listed the people we've hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. We found that at the end of the resentment inventory and partway through the sexual misconduct inventory. So that's a summary. It's a checklist. It looks like we did all those things. It says in this book you read again and again, faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you're now convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you've made a decision, that would be the third step decision, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps that we just talked about, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. I studied biology. I know what happens after swallow and digest. That stuff's out of here. And that's what step 4 is about. It's out of here. And we're going to start talking about step 5 in 12 minutes and 24 seconds. We're going to begin the discussion on step 5 and page 72, which has a suggestion as to why we might want to consider actually doing this, which goes totally against the grain of everything I've ever been told. My buddy Kip says even if they've got a movie of it, plead not guilty and ask for a jury trial, and which I think he did that quite a few times. About 6 lines from the bottom, we'll be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should. The first reason first, if we skip this vital, once again necessary to life, this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Oh, well, that's an interesting one. Page 73, first indentation. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He's very much there. Here we are back to the actor. You remember the actor who wanted to run the whole show? Here we're back to the actor. He's very much the actor. To the outer world, he likes to present his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. That's the hole that Bob's talking about. That's the God-shaped hole. And I have to dig the poison out of here first before we can fill with the good stuff. I have let's skip down here a couple of paragraphs. It says, psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We spend thousands of dollars for examinations. We know of but few instances where we've given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. I've got a friend that says he thinks alcoholics should go to veterinarians because they're used to trying to guess what's wrong with their patients. Because, you know, we're not telling them. Last line, we must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long or happily in this world. Boy, did just threaten my life all day long. Just doesn't bother him at all to threaten my very existence in this thing. And then it begins, you have to remember this thing was written. They claimed to have 100 people sober, and I think they were pretty optimistic on that. So it wasn't like there were sponsors on every corner to hear this fifth step with. And it talks about, in the next couple of paragraphs, selecting someone. And I want to tell a story from my own experience. My sponsor sponsored a guy who chose to do his fifth step with his preacher on a Saturday. On the next day, on Sunday, he and his wife were in the front row as the preacher did his fifth step for the congregation, complete with his name. True story. I met that guy. Devastated doesn't begin to cover what happened. And I'm not downing religions at all. But I think it was necessary for my sponsor to hear my fifth step. I tell the guys I sponsor, you can take your fifth step with anybody you want to, and me. Because I need to know, because I'm going to hear things in your fifth step that we're going to need on your eighth step that you're going to miss. Because that's what happens. And because I think you need to be in the hands of someone who has heart knowledge of this. And I have heart knowledge because I have done it. Interestingly enough, paragraph at the bottom of the page begins with notwithstanding. You're going to hear there aren't any rules in AA? Well, let's take a look at a couple of the rules. Three lines up. The rule is, we must be hard on ourselves but always considerate of others. That means I can't do my fifth step with my mother because she doesn't need to hear the details on it. And just for fun, page 101, I dig out a couple of more rules just for fun. Second paragraph from the bottom, page 101. I'm trying to slow down. I've been asked to slow down. Do you believe I'm from Tennessee and can talk this fast? So our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking if we have a legitimate reason for being there. It goes on to say that you better make sure you're in good shape spiritually to do that. There's also a rule on page 118. Second full paragraph. Your husband knows he owes you more than sobriety he wants to make good. You must not expect too much. His ways of thinking and doing are habits of years. Patience, tolerance, understanding, and love are the watchwords. Show him these things in yourself, and they will be reflected back to you from him. Live and let live is the rule. So I found three rules, and I'm not saying there aren't more. Back to page 75. It says, when we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory, and we're prepared for a long talk. And I know that different, I don't find anything in the literature that tells me how to hear a fifth step. So all I have is what my lineage has passed to me. Mine is probably a bit different from Bob's and probably different from yours. I'm not saying any of them are right or wrong. This is just the way it was given to me. And that's that I don't need to hear you read your fourth step. You can read it into your tape recorder and I'll play it on planes and stuff. That's not what this is about. The fifth step is a confession. And I do on occasion let people refer to it. I don't think that's a bad idea. But it's confession. And I understand, as it says here, that it's a life or death errand, because I know you're going to die if you don't tell me the truth. And I like when I'm with a new guy and it's his first fifth step, I say, how do you feel? Are you nervous? He says, no, I feel pretty good. We're wasting our time with him, because he already knows what he's not going to tell me. Right? If he's not a little bit nervous, he knows what he's not going to tell. I want him puckered. Because he either knows he's going to tell me, or he's afraid there's a pretty good chance he is. I'll settle for either one of those. Because I'll extract it if he'll get that close. And it gives me a one-sentence direction on how to do a fifth step. It says we pocket our pride. That means I've got to give up what you think about me. We pocket our pride and go to it. Illuminating, that means to shine light into. Every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. So at this point, what I like to do is, because I don't want to spend the next 3 days listening to your fifth step, and I've learned to do this, and whatever you want to do suits me. I want to start with a prayer. I'm going to ask him to pray for clarity of mind and the courage to say it. And I'm going to pray, and I'm going to ask God to make me perfect for this time. And this is one of the places where I get to do that. Page 13. Paragraph near the bottom of the page, I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. I feel really good about asking God to make me perfect when I sit there at this step with somebody. I ask him to make me a channel, and I promise him that whatever seems to be the right thing, whatever guidance I feel like I'm getting, I will do. And I wrapped a guy in a blanket, held him for 45 minutes while he bawled about his father. I don't know to do that. I don't know that. And I believe when I ask God for what he wants me to have, I get a lot of help. It's always about me getting to the right question. It's always about me getting to the right question. And I think that's a good one. Back on page 75. So I ask him to make me perfect. And in my lineage, we don't hear fist steps. We exchange. And as he talks about the worst things he's ever done, if I've done that one or something close, he hears mine. I don't lead, although I will if I have to. Better for him to tell it first, I think. And what I say, the way I want to start this thing, because I don't want to spend the rest of our lives here, is I want you to tell me the single worst thing you've ever done. I want to hear it first. Okay, and then I tell him, yeah, I did that too. And then I want to hear the next worst thing you've ever done. And I do that until he's not sure what order they're in. And then I'll take whatever else you got that are worst things, and then let's flip around to your fourth step and look for some other stuff that you did wrong. And the fifth steps I hear run somewhere between an hour and a half and 2 hours. And that's just how I've learned to do it. Because that's what we have here is a confession. He's gonna illuminate every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. If I let him start out telling the story of his life, or start out with the little, you know, the little light duty ones, you know, I was in a fight when I was 9 on the schoolyard, that kind of thing, there's no telling how long it may take us to get to the worst stuff. I don't think there's an upper limit to how long that can take. And that's just what I do. And whatever you do is just okay with me. When he thinks he's finished and when I think he's finished, I ask a series of questions. And here they are. I ask if he's ever physically harmed anyone or if he's ever physically harmed an animal. It's amazing how many of us have beaten dogs, done those kinds of things. I ask, if I haven't heard it, I ask if he's had a homosexual experience. I ask if he's had sex with a family member or an animal. I ask if he's been involved in abortion. That's, I know, a hot political topic, but there's a lot of pain in some people who've been involved in those. I'm going to talk about that later. But sometimes that's the heavy one. And I also ask him if there's anything he had decided not to tell me or if he was unsure that he hasn't already told me. And then I assure him that over the next day or two, he may have some other things bubble up. About half the time, a guy will call me over the next 48 hours with something else. I say, it's really common. Doesn't mean you've done a poor job. Just call me. Let's get in a place where we can both talk. I'll take that other piece on the phone. It's not a problem. It's real common. And then I like to tell him that I believe God forgives him and that I absolutely forgive him. And that as we complete this process, in particular step 9, we will get to the point where he's forgiven himself, because that's been my experience with it. And then I like to read him the fifth step promises. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. That is a powerful set of promises. This is my experience. The first time I told somebody the whole story was where I began to get free. I still have those memories, but they no longer have stench or weight. And the thing that keeps them clean is my willingness for God to use them to help somebody else. I think I'm two things, and when I have these in place, I'm in really good shape. I'm God's caddy in the sense of a golf caddy. I'm carrying this stuff for his use. I got it right here. It's not hard to carry. And the other thing is, I'm an apprentice messenger. It says we tried to carry this message. I'm trying to carry the message. I think that makes me an apprentice messenger. Step 12. It doesn't say we carried it, it says we tried. If I continue in here, whatever you think of me doesn't matter. If I continue in here to be God's caddy and an apprentice messenger, I do pretty good. When I get beyond that, when I get up above that, I get into real trouble. Having read that to him, I now tell him, congratulations, you've now completed the first half of step 5. And I'm going to read to you now the directions for the second half of step 5. It says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. I want you to go home. I don't want the radio on. I don't want a CD of a speaker on. No noise in the car. I want you to go straight home. I don't want you to stop. Go to a place where you can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we've done. We thank God. Here's a prayer from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. Believe me, as you tell this truth and your sponsor does not run screaming, you will get this closeness. It's a wonderful experience. taking this book down from our shelf. Now, Bob laughs at me again. I require them to put their book up on a shelf. Okay, and I'm going to want to know tomorrow that you put your book up on a shelf and took your hand away and then reached up and grabbed it. I'll be good with that. But it's an attitude. I think it sounds absolutely insane, and I insist on it. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps, carefully reading the first five proposals. So you're going to carefully, that might mean like slowly, carefully reading the first five. We ask, there's another prayer, if we have omitted anything, for we're building an arch through which we shall walk a free man. So here we are back at the arch again. Remember we had that in step three, the keystone of the new and triumphant arch? Here we are continuing to build the arch. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Powerful, powerful, powerful stuff. And then it says, amazingly enough, at the top of page 76, if, after 1 hour, if we can answer to our satisfaction, in other words, if we've been thorough, then we look at step six. If not, you need to call me. And let's get the other pieces in place. It says, we have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? That's a simple question. You wanted God to have this, or aren't you? It's not an essay question. It's a yes or no. And then here's the six-step prayer. If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. Simple prayer. I don't want to let go of this one, Father. Please take it. Please help me be willing. And says, when ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step seven. See, what I know that he doesn't know is that when he completes his fourth step, he's about 2 days from step eight. He doesn't know that. I don't think he needs to know, because we're going to keep moving on this thing. They recently added to the seven-step prayer a phrase, if you know what I mean, how they sneak in and add stuff. Here's one that they added not too long ago. It says that you remove from me every single defect of character. That's where I thought it stopped. It says, which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. It doesn't say I'm asking you to remove them all. It doesn't say that. It just says to remove the ones that stand in the way of my usefulness. That's a powerful difference. And I never would have seen that. I speak at a lot of conferences, and being a circuit speaker has accompanying it a predictable set of personality disorders. And that is that when you tell me how great I am, I start to believe you. That's what it comes down to. It's the reemergence of ego. And if there's anything uglier on the planet, I've not run across it. And I had a bad case of it a couple of years ago. A bad case. And I started thinking I was pretty super. That's not a good place for me. And the gift I got was that one of my character defects flared. And I almost did something in sobriety that I would have been terribly ashamed of. And my analysis on that today is that God used one of my character defects as a tool to help me. It had never crossed my mind that this God is so powerful that he will take some of the worst things in me and use them as tools to help me or you. Absolutely astonishing to me. Here's a gift from my sponsor. Here's another. My mentor said that the alcoholic is like an electromagnet that's been dragged through the junkyard of life. And we've got all this rusty, jagged stuff stuck all over us. And what we do with these steps, particularly 4, 5, 8, and 9, is we very slowly turn off the power. And all this nasty, jagged stuff drops away. And this beautiful thing I've always really been is sort of left hanging there. It's not like I'm going to change me into something. Another one of my teachers says, I don't need to get this mental image of what a spiritual Scott would look like and sort of live into that. Because that's my history. Figure out what I think you want me to be and then go try to be it. That's not what this is about. This is about turning off the power. This is about stopping doing the stuff that's not really me and allowing who I really am to emerge. That was a very foreign concept to me because the only truth I know for sure when I got to you is that I'm not good enough. I don't measure up. I'm defective. There are things wrong with me that cannot be repaired. And if a bunch of together people like you ever saw through my last mask, you wouldn't want me around. That's the only thing I knew for sure when I got to you. Because that's what I've been hiding from the world all of my life. I've been hiding that. They changed page 164. Summer of 2004, I swear it wasn't here. And it says, still you may say, but I will not have the benefit of contact with you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that, so you must remember that your real reliance is always upon Him. Here it comes. Here's the new part. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Crave is a powerful word. And I have craved fellowship all of my life. I've never had it. I have craved it. I tell the earthlings they shouldn't use the word crave. They don't know what it means. They don't. I say, you want to know what crave is? I know what crave is. Hold your breath for the next 5 minutes. For the last 20 seconds of that, you will know what crave means. We know what crave means. I have craved fellowship all my life, never had it. The reason is because I'm doing this act. See, I'm this actor here. I'm pretending to be this guy. I'm pretending to be that guy or the other. I'm pretending to be something. I'm holding something up in front of me. You know, I'm like the wizard behind the curtain. Always doing that kind of stuff. And I got to hang out with you, but I didn't get to participate in fellowship. And the reason is because I wasn't showing you this part. And this is the only part that can participate in fellowship. And at step 5, I have shown this part to somebody. I did it. I really did the fist step the first time. And I felt different. I felt lighter. My skin started to fit. And it never had before, unless I was drinking. It never fit. And all of a sudden, I began to have the fellowship that I crave. And only this part can participate in fellowship. And that's why I said the actors don't get sober. The victims don't get sober. I've got to quit all those acts and begin to learn who I really am. And I'm a child of God. And God was not having a bad day in the middle of a long losing streak when He came up with me or any of you. It did not happen that way. And although there are things about me that need to be worked on, I think of us as gemstones. Faceted gemstone, like a diamond's got the different sides. Some of the facets are already cut and they're really beautiful and shiny. And some are in progress and looking pretty good. Some are not even started. None of that matters. The fact is, it's a gemstone. And what matters is that there is a facet turned toward me today. And the question is, what kind of a job am I doing cutting that one? I'm told that my life, that I'm the builder, God's the architect. And I don't get to see the plans. All I get is today's stone to put in place. Now, I like the Kelly greens and the sky blues. But there are some gray ones. And there's some black ones, too. And each day is a stone. And it's my job to shape and polish that stone, whatever color, and to put it in place as best I can. And I don't get to see the master plan until it's complete. That's a little bit about what a day at a time is about. My great sponsor, somebody asked me one time, does the path narrow? I hear people say the path narrows. The truth is, if I stay on the center line, I won't notice. My job is to get to the center line and stay there and continue to correct back. That's what flying is. The instrument flying, nobody's ever got it perfect. But if you're correcting back to everything, you're doing really good. That's what this is about. That's what this 11-step inventory at night and in the morning are about. They're about correcting back. We're going to talk about that tomorrow. My sponsor told me, step 6 and 7 don't say anything at all about you removing your own defects of character or working on your defects of character. He said, that's a classic example of living in the problem. Classic example. He said, self does not have the power to push self out of the center. If it did, it would leave a vacuum. So the answer to my character defects isn't for me to work on them. The answer is for me to do the things that you have taught me to lead a spiritual life. I've got, at 2 years sober, I was working on 3 of my character defects. And I mean, I was about to get a brain hernia. I was really working on them. And one of them was lying. Not actually lying, really improvements on the truth. Lying, swearing, and my attitude toward those of you who probably got your driver's licenses out of Cracker Jack boxes. And I was working on those things. And boy, I was just getting crazier by the minute. And what I discovered was that today, even to this day, those are my spiritual barometers. Those are the things that tell me where I am spiritually. If you cut me off in trafficking, I get upset. If I hear me lying, if I hear me swearing, those things tell me that I'm out of whack spiritually. So I don't work on my lying. I don't work on my attitude in traffic. I inventory over the last few days. I was told this a long time ago. My priority is not what I say it is. My priority is what I do. If I want to know what my priorities are, I don't listen to my words about the future. I look at my actions in the recent past. What was accomplished was a priority. What was not accomplished was not a priority. And anything that I'm saying to the contrary is a lie that I'm telling me. And I hated that when I first heard it, because I was saying a bunch of things were priorities and I wasn't doing anything about them. And I was lying to me. And so what I do when I hear me angry with you in traffic or lying or swearing is I inventory my spiritual actions over the last few days. When's the last time I talked to my sponsor? How many new guys am I sponsoring? When's the last time I took a meeting into a jail or a treatment center? What's my morning prayer look like? Morning meditation is the one that I tend to get away from. What am I not doing that I know how to do? And I go back to doing those things that you have taught me. And 2 days later, you can cut me off in traffic and almost hit me. And I will smile at you from the depths of my soul. And I'll wave at you and I'll wave my entire hand. I'll wave the whole thing. And they do that here. And I'll say, God, go with that one. He needs some help today. And thank you so much that I was alert and saw it coming. And we're not in a wreck now. It would have been his fault. But thanks that we're not in a wreck because I was able to do that. I wish him the best and mean that. And I can't change me from the screaming maniac 2 days ago. I don't have the power. But what Mike told me, my sponsor told me, was that self can't push self out of the center. It will leave the vacuum. And that when I do the things you've taught me to lead a God-centered life, when I do that, my character defects just recede. I don't take power over them. What I do is I invite the light in and the darkness flees, because the darkness can't exist in the light. Thanks.
Great, great job. Thanks, Scott. I'm Bob, still an alcoholic. Step five is the first risk that I have to take. And I think it's an adage that you don't have a shot of ever really feeling good until you're willing to look bad. And this is the first chance I get where I have to be willing to look bad. I have to be willing to walk through my fears. And I think one of the great things that I find out that I'm wrong about in step five is that I secret my fear. What was my fear in step five? Is that if you knew about me, what I know about me, you would feel about me the way I feel about me. And so everybody I know comes out the backside of step five, and that's another thing you're wrong about. If I would have been right about that, the person who'd heard my fifth step would have beat me up after the fifth step. Instead, we became closer. I was wrong about that, too. Step six is a tough deal for some of us, because I'm not real honest with myself, and that's okay. I don't know that I'm not real honest, and that's the problem. And so when I get to my first approach to step six, and I see these things are objectionable, and I see these defects that have caused me a lot of problems in my life, and I ask God to remove them, and nothing happens. And I ask him for the willingness, but the truth is, I don't really want it. And I don't understand, and what I'm doing is I'm going to God asking him, I think, to remove the defect, and I'm not really. I'm really asking him to remove the consequences. And there's a difference. And in Bill's story, there's a section where Bill goes through a thumbnail sketch of the steps, and he talks about six and seven, and he says he asks his creator to remove these things, root and branch, which means that there's two parts. And that's the problem. There's the branch, which keeps poking me in the eye. I want God to take that. But I want to hold on to the root, which is the secret illusion of value. The thing that I hold on to because I secretly think I have to have that in order to survive. And so what my experience has been with step six is an endless process of hitting these little bottoms with stuff in sobriety. My sponsor has a great saying. He says, you get to Alcoholics Anonymous and you're so beaten up by the bottle, you throw the towel in. And then you get just enough self-esteem to be dangerous and nobody's looking. You sneak the towel back. And you'll spend the rest of your life tearing off little bits of it and throwing it in. So, what so-and-so shares at meetings and the stupid people in AA and the IRS and the boss and on and on and on and on. And I think that's true for me. When I was brand new, I was very surrendered. And then I got just enough self-esteem to be dangerous. And I started hedging my bet. And I got to this point, and I in step six, and I don't really want it to be removed. I want the consequences to go. And they're a package.